Yeah, so at the moment we're looking at stories and symbols that can illustrate the Dharma. I was going to say in the Buddhist tradition, but I don't think the Lumpton worm comes into it, into the Buddhist tradition, and that's what we talked about last week. And we looked at stories and symbols concerning the problem of the spiritual life, concerning the ideal, what we're moving towards in the spiritual life. Now we're looking at the path. And the path we've decided to look at in terms of Sangharakshita's system of meditation, which you can also look at as a kind of a way to practice or a path to practice, which starts off with integration and goes to positive emotion, spiritual death and spiritual rebirth. And we're looking at the moment at integration, stories to do with integration. And we've looked so far at integrating the shadow side, facing up to your shadow side, and dealing with your own shadow side instead of moaning about other people's shadow side all the time. So tonight what we're going to do is we're going to look at a story from the Buddhist tradition, Tibetan Buddhist tradition, and it's also about integration. It's about integration in terms of not dissipating your energy, not just gathering all your energy in the same direction. So that's what we're going to look at. And the story concerns... if I can find the piece of paper. Padmasambhava. Another incredibly long Buddhist Sanskrit name. So Padmasambhava, the story goes like this. When Buddhism was being established in Tibet, there was a very good monk called Shantirakshita who was quite a traditional monk, and he was asked by the king of Tibet to help bring Buddhism to Tibet. He was quite a scholarly man, and by all accounts, enormous positive emotion, very, very good man, very comprehensive understanding of the Dharma, very kind. And what happened was that he started to build a monastery, Samiling Monastery in Tibet. But a funny thing happened. In this monastery, by day, he'd have all the monks and workers building the monastery, and they'd all get so far. And then, you know, they'd knock off at the end of the day, right, let's go have a beer or whatever you do in Tibet when you're trying to relax. And out would creep, under the cover of darkness, the demons and the ogres and the nymphs and the naughty beings of Tibet, and they'd go and they'd undo all the good work that all the nice monks had done in the daytime with a little mischievous, impious look in their eyes. And of course, so Shantirakshita and the workers and the monks would come the next day and just go, oh my god, you know, what's going on here? And in the end, Shantirakshita said, look, there's one person who can help with this, one person only. And his name is Padmasambhava. So the king said, okay, well, let's get him up. He's a famous teacher in northern India, quite accomplished spiritually. Let's invite him up to Tibet to build the monastery and establish Buddhism in Tibet. So, Shantirakshita sent word to Padmasambhava, sent a message to him, and Padmasambhava, the date arrived, which would have been an auspicious date for Padmasambhava to arrive in Tibet. And the king came with, he decided to meet him at this particular river. So the king was waiting on one side of the river, but he wasn't alone. He decided to bring with him his entire army of iron-clad horsemen. So I always imagine this a bit like Lord of the Rings, you know, there's just this sea of men. Iron-clad horseman with very shiny armour. Probably hasn't been used an awful lot, you know, but it's definitely there for show. So he has an entire army. And then he brings out his queens. He's got two queens, and they come wearing the most exquisite silk robes with coral and turquoise and gold perfumed by sandalwood. And, of course, these queens, they don't come alone. No, they come with a whole entourage of maidens and servants, all coming up on fine horses. And they set up tents. They set up tents made out of silk, with beautiful jewels and beautiful banners, as far as the eye can see. So the king, you know, welcome to Tibet, to Padmasambhava. So this is what the king did. He waited on the other side of the river. And of course, Padmasambhava came. Now, Padmasambhava is a bit of a character, actually. I should have brought a picture. If you've seen Pirates of the Caribbean and Captain Jack Sparrow, you pretty much got a bit what Padmasambhava is like. He was a very beautiful man, long black hair with golden earrings, and he was a bit like a magician. He had a kind of black beard and slightly unruly. I mean, he was a man not to be tamed in any way. And he was wearing his long flowing robes. He carries with him a trident, a staff, sometimes depicted with three decaying heads on it, a freshly severed skull, a freshly dead head, and someone in between. He holds a vajra. He has a cap with a vulture's feather in it. He's the kind of man who'd probably come up and jangle, you know. He would sort of make funny noises like that when he moved around. He was definitely not your ordinary run-of-the-mill, quiet Buddhist monk, quiet and kind and scholarly chap. He was the master of the cities. He was the master of attainments, and he wasn't frightened of anyone. He wasn't going to be put off by this enormous entourage. So Padmasambhava came up, and he looked at all this. He looked at all this entourage, and he was decidedly unimpressed. And the king sort of made a little bow, as he would have. And Padmasambhava said to himself, he said, Padma, it says, Padma, the great one, reflected, who are we, he and I? Plunged in darkness is his mind. I am learned in the five realms of knowledge, Buddha in a single lifetime, exempt from birth and death. It is out of necessity that he invites me here. The king bowed down before me. Shall I or shall I not return his bow? If yes, the majesty of the Dharma will be slighted. If no, since he is king, he will be angered. Yet however great he may be, bow down, I cannot. So you can imagine one of these awkward silences. The king's just on this sort of slight nod in Padmasambhava's direction. And then there's just a big silence. And it says in the text that the whole entourage was quivering like a brood of pigeons. With all their plumes and their silk. You can have it just, it just reminds me of just a very, very English moment. Oh my God, what do we do now? So there's a very long silence. And then the king starts to get really pissed off. And he starts to say, I am sovereign over all the black heads of Tibet. Shantirakshita has already made obeisance to me. The guru Padmasambhava must prostrate himself as well. So he just stood there, the two giants standing it out. And then Padmasambhava sang a song. So this is the, I'm not going to sing it, and it's a slightly extracted version because it's quite long, but I'll tell you a bit of it. I am Padmasambhava, the holy Dharma. Mine are the teachings for assured ascension in the Dharma. Externally, I am a saffron-robed monk. Within, yogi of the supreme secret mantras. I am Padmasambhava, the monk. Mine are the teachings of the interpenetration of the theory and practice of the scriptures. My wisdom is as vast as the sky. My conduct as fine as grains of flour. I am Padmasambhava of lofty meditation. Mine are the teachings on contemplating the Dharma outside the time of meditation. In the circle of samsara and nirvana, there is no accepting or rejecting. I am Padmasambhava, the doctor. Mine is the nectar of the Dharma, the teachings that cure one of death. I am Padmasambhava, the sorcerer. Mine are the teachings of the Dharma that transmutes negative mental states. I do not bid farewell to pleasures. I take them with me on the path. I exult in the wisdom of the Buddhas. I am Padmasambhava the king. Mine are the teachings of the Dharma, possessing authority in the three realms. I embrace and shake the profound cycle of conditions. I accomplish every action, subjugating the mind itself. I am Padmasambhava the Lord. Mine are the teachings of the doctrine that scrutinizes and pronounces upon error. When the Bodhisattva's compassion, with the Bodhisattva's compassion as the blade, I have slaughtered inimical wrong views and misconceptions. I am Padmasambhava, the hero. Mine are the teachings of the Dharma that treads underfoot the hostile wheel of life. Having assigned the heritage of these gifts, I establish my fortunate children in the Dharma. I am Padmasambhava, the unborn. Mine are the teachings of the great seal of the Dharma. My diamond body will never decay, for my mind, in awakening, is perennial lucidity. And you, king of barbarian Tibet, king of the country without virtue, uncouth men and ogres surround you. You rely upon famine serfs, and neither joy nor good humour are yours. As for your queens, they are demons in human shape. Beautiful purple ghouls surround them. Sandalwood, turquoise and gold adorn them, but they have no hearts or minds. You are king, your lungs swell. Great is your power, your liver is well satisfied. Scepter in hand and haughty, you stand high, but I, sire, will not bow down before you. And yet, in accordance with my conjoined vows, having come to the heart of Tibet, here I stay. Great king, witness, have I come. And then Padmasambhava takes his hand out of his robe, and out of his fingertips emerge flames of fire, which he passes over all the entourage, and under which force they fall to the ground in prostration, like a scythe taken to sheaves of corn. So, not one for a small entrance, Padmasambhava. So, yes. I have to say, they all did live in happily ever after. They didn't die of burns. It seems sort of a bit extreme thing to do, Padmasambhava. So what is it talking about? What is this all about? Well, in a way, what it means is that he refuses to go for refuge, or he refuses to bow down to not only the king, but what the king represents. He refuses to supplicate. So, in traditional Buddhist terminology, stretching right back from the time of the Buddha, the phrase is going for refuge, which is saranar gamana. Gamana means movement towards or going for, and sarana means protection or refuge. So sometimes we know that as saranangachami, which means I go for refuge. And that's what we're going to talk about, or I'm going to talk about, and you're going to listen. About tonight, about refuges and what this whole idea of bowing down, of making obeisance, of going for refuge to something means. Because basically what Padmasambhava realises is that the spiritual life is better. It's better than everything that the king represents, the king and his show of worldly power represents. And he decides that actually the spiritual life is more worthy of supplication, is more worthy of going for refuge to. So it's a bit like on one side of the river you've got the king, and he represents worldly power. He represents worldly achievements. He represents what we'd call the false refuges. And on the other side you've got Padmasambhava, and Padmasambhava represents spiritual power, who represents the true refuges. And in this story it's the true refuges, it's the spiritual power that's in charge. that will not subjugate to worldly power. Because if he does, if Padmasambhava realizes that if he bows down to that worldly power, then he's devaluing and undermining the spiritual power. So I put, it's a bit like a lion bowing down to a worm. That's how Padmasambhava sort of sees it. Nothing wrong with worms, they're great creatures, but you know. So we're going to look a bit at this. In a way, in Buddhism, the kind of teaching is that we're always going for refuge. In a way, we're always bowing down to something. We're always making obeisance to something. We're always supplicating, in a way, to something. Always going for refuge to something. And well, why is that? So in a way, what you've got to start with going for refuge, the whole kind of terminology of going for refuge is, well, what are you going for refuge from? Why do we always need to go towards something? What is it we're kind of running from? And the Buddhist answer, actually I haven't written this down, is something called dukkha. It says that all the time, dukkha or unsatisfactoriness. So there's three levels of dukkha. And the first level is actual dukkha. So actual dukkha you could see in terms of not getting what we want and getting what we don't want. It's kind of actual pain. It's loss. It's grief. It's physical pain. It's the unpleasantness of life, being separated from what you want and being handed a load of what you don't want in life. So that's the kind of first level, is actual dukkha. And the second level is psychological. So psychological dukkha is the kind of feeling like, well, in our heart of hearts, we all know that it's going to end. So you can get everything, you know, kind of nicely the way you want it. But there's always that kind of seed of insecurity that actually you know that it can't last forever. My mum was telling me when she first started working, she got 2 weeks off a year. And she said most of the year she spent looking forward to this 2 weeks. And then when she got on the 2 weeks, she felt completely miserable because she knew it was going to end. So in a way, it's a bit like psychological dukkha is like those 2 weeks. It's like, you know in your heart of hearts, nothing lasts forever. There's a feeling of insecurity that suffering may happen to you. And the third level is existential. And in a way, some ways this is the most important, not always, but in some ways it's the most important. An existential dukkha is when you realise that, okay, this is all okay as far as it goes, but it doesn't go far enough. And it's when you get the feeling that, like, you've got a really limited conception of what your life is about. And it's not enough. It's just not big enough. It's like you can't be squeezed into that shape. So you know that feeling where everything's going really nice. You know, you've got a great job, got a great boyfriend, nice house, nice clothes. You're kind of quite psychologically healthy or whatever. And you're a bit bored. There's this kind of feeling of, yeah, and then what? You know. So Subhuti compares this to, I quite like this image. He says it's a bit like we're all lions in cages. You know, with a great big creature with loads of energy and loads of power and beautiful silky coats. And you know, the leopards and lions, they kind of have these rippling muscles. You know, there's so much in there. There's so much power. There's so much force. And we're all in cages. And all we can do is kind of walk around these cages just thinking, there's more than this. That it's like I've got more potential. You know, I could do more than this. But somehow your life isn't big enough. It kind of reminds me of the... I was listening to Nirvana this morning, and there's that song that goes, something in the way, You know, there's just something in the way. This isn't quite right. It's being sold to me as if this is the pinnacle of human existence, but it's not. Sangharakshita talks about existential loneliness as well in his book Yogi's Joy, which is quite a good thing to read. And he says that actually To the extent that you experience yourself as a self separate from other individuals, to that extent you will always feel a certain amount of loneliness. You will always experience a chasm between yourself and other people. In a way, well, that's what happens. That's part of life. Part of life is, until you go beyond the distinction between self and other, you will always be separated from other people. You'll always be slightly separated from the world. And there can be this kind of feeling of loneliness. That in a way, it can even happen when you're in the midst of loads of people. In fact, it can be even more intense when you're with a really, really good friend. Because you sort of realise that, you're having really great communication and you're really with them in some sense. But actually, because you haven't transcended the boundaries between self and other, you are really aware of this kind of chasm that separates you. And I think the point is, that dukkha is always there in some form or another. It's not that we never experience pleasure, because we do. We can sometimes have very, very pleasurable experiences. But particularly in our idle moments, there can be this nagging feeling that something isn't quite right. And quite a lot of the time, Buddhists, we do this thing, if you've gone on quite a few retreats before, in the end you go on a solitary retreat. And it's really interesting, actually, because you don't have any distractions. You don't have a TV, you don't have a book. Well, I mean, you do have books, but you don't have loads of trashy novels. You don't have mates to go down to the pub with. And usually you're in a caravan in Wales and it's raining. So, you're kind of left with, I cover this over, but there's always this nagging feeling underneath. Something isn't quite right. There could be just something a little bit more. So what we do is that we try and get away from that feeling. A lot of our lives is spent running away from that feeling. What we do is we go for refuge from it. We go for refuge. We try and seek some sort of security, some sort of way out from this feeling, something that's going to make it all right. So what are we looking for? Well, I think the criteria for a refuge that's really going to help you in this feeling, because in a way, I think it's okay. I think it's okay that we want to get away from that feeling, because actually it's not very nice. And it causes a certain... Well, it is suffering, so of course it causes suffering, It's not very nice, and it's okay to want to get away from it. But we've got to be realistic about what we're looking for, what we need to get away from that kind of nagging feeling. So there's four things. It's got to be something that's permanent. If the refuge won't last, if the place where you're going for security won't last, you can't rely on it. It's not going to do it for you. Sooner or later, it's going to let you down. So that's one thing. It's got to be permanent. The other thing is it's got to have unlimited depth. So some things can take you a long way. But if they're going to run out sooner or later, then you need something a bit more. You can't have a place of security, a refuge, that doesn't have enough depth. It's a bit like philosophy. Okay, philosophy and rationality can get you really, really far. It's a really great thing to do. It mainly makes you think clearly. It really helps you understand points about the Dharma. But actually, it's limited at least by your rational mind. And what you'll find is you'll come up, if you try and just do the Buddhist life intellectually, you'll come up sooner or later against a kind of wall. And that's not to say you should just abandon it altogether and never get to the point of getting to the wall. But it's limited. Philosophy, intellectualism is limited. You're going to reach the point where your intellect can't go any further, your reason can't go any further. So it's not a limitless refuge. And often we find that with things. We can get really, really enthusiastic about things, and they really work. They genuinely work. We genuinely get a lot out of them. But they don't take us any further. They're going to get us to a point, and then that's it. They just don't seem to be able to take you all away. So by all means, experiment with those things, but they're not a true refuge. They're not really going to help you from the point of view of giving you security against dukkha because they're limited. The other thing is that refuges need to have an unlimited breadth. They have to include all of you. Because at the moment we are unintegrated. And there are going to be parts of us that want to do one thing and parts of us that want to do another thing. You know, there's parts of us that want to go and, there's parts of me that think, yeah, it'd be really great. You know, it's a bit like I think I have these fantasies about solitary retreats and I'll get this really nice kind of little cabin and Wales. I could just have it there and it'd be really great. And then when I get there, all I want to be is back down in town, you know. And then I think, no, solitary retreats are rubbish. What we need is we really need to engage with the world. We need to be heroes and heroines and to battle the forces of greed, hatred and delusion. And we need to go and save all beings. So it's a bit like, well, we've got all these bits of us that want to do different things, you know. And your refuge has to be big enough to hold them all, to hold that kind of conflicting desires that's you. So a refuge should be something that enables you not to sit on big parts of yourself. If you're going to sit on a big part of yourself, it's going to come out sooner or later. You can't sit on something forever. If there's a strong desire within you, you have to include it in your life. You can't sit on it forever. You can't deny it's there. So the refuge has to include unlimited breadth. And the last thing is, it has to be limitlessly beautiful. It has to be really, really attractive. We won't do anything unless we're emotionally engaged with it, unless on some level we find it, it's kind of got to entice us. Otherwise, it's going to be a bit cold and dead. And even though intellectually we think it's a really, really good idea, yeah, I should really go for refuge in this place because that's, you know, it's permanent and it's really broad and it's really deep and that would be a really good idea. But unless it's attractive to us, unless it in some way holds a sense of beauty for us, actually we're just going to do something different. So it's important that whatever our refuge is going to be beautiful. So what tends to happen is this, you might have an idea about what's coming up next, is that well, in a way, we're always looking to get away from this sense of dukkha, this sense of unsatisfactoriness. And we're always looking for a refuge away from this nagging feeling inside of us. But we go for refuge to all the wrong places. We go for refuge to things that cannot give us permanency, that aren't deep enough, that aren't broad enough, and aren't beautiful enough. We go for refuge things that just can't really satisfy us. So sometimes it's compared, someone compared it to, it's a bit like we've got a wound and we keep blowing on it. Well, if you've ever done that, what you find is it, for the moment that you breathe on it, there's a kind of little sense of satisfaction. But as soon as you stop breathing on it, it just starts hurting again. So what you find is that you have to spend all day going. Once you start, you just can't stop, you know. You know, it's like I've kind of got this vision of us all kind of, you know, it's all a bit frightening. So we're all kind of just trying to patch it up. You know, it's a bit like there's a leaking roof, a leak in the ceiling, and we just go, right, let's just go to the other room. And then that roof starts leaking. And then, well, no, it's all right. We'll just put a bucket there, you know, and then the whole roof drops down, you know. It's like we're always trying to make do with things that don't really work, that don't really do it for us. And in a funny kind of way, because we go for refuge to things that don't really do it for us, we kind of become slaves to our false refuges. We become slaves to these things that won't really give us satisfaction in the desperate hope that they will eventually. So it's a bit like, you know, when you're eating, you know, you kind of... you get that food often comes into this sense of dissatisfaction. Like, so say you're at home working all day and you feel a bit bored and like you're not quite engaged, so you go and start eating and there's a kind of momentary satisfaction there, momentary, but of course when you finish eating, what do you do then? You've just got to go back to work. So what you do is you just keep eating, and the more you keep eating, the more you can't stop. It's like you're not even tasting anymore, you just have to keep putting it in your mouth. So that's what we're like. We kind of go on automatic pilot. These things don't work, so we think we've got to have more of them, which is a bit of a strange view, actually. So in terms of the story of Padmasambhava, what we're doing is we're supplicating all the wrong things. We're looking to all the wrong things to give us a sense of satisfaction. And the more we supplicate to them, the more we have to keep doing it in the hope, you know, it's a bit like, there's this king. And we think, oh, this king could really give us something here. Maybe this king is going to make it all right for us. So we go and we supplicate the king, and he gives us a little bit. But it's a bit paltry. So we just keep on becoming more and more and more sycophantic, you know. Please, please, please. And we can't get out of this cycle of kind of making obeisance. We cling to them desperately because we don't know where else to turn. It's a bit like in the Christian tradition, it will be making offerings to false gods. You know, the more you start doing that, you more think, well, I can't stop giving them a offering now, because it might turn out that they're right, you know, they might turn out that they really exist, and then if I stop giving them an offering, then they might, you know, send down a hailstorm on my head or something. So it's a bit like this, we're always looking for the wrong refuges in the wrong places, and the more we do that, the more we have to carry on doing that. So going back to the story, well, what are the false refuges that the king represents, the king and his entourage represent? Because I think this is quite interesting. I think in a way this is the main false refuges that we look towards for satisfaction. So the first one I'm going to draw attention to is the queens. Because I think what we do to get away from this sense of dissatisfaction is the kind of first port of call is other people and sexual relationships in particular. So obviously, as a Buddhist, I think one wonders what I'm going for refuge to, really. As a Buddhist, yes, good. Who does the metta bhavana? I'm not going to tell you that there's something wrong with other people and we should just ignore each other. That's not really the way to go. There's nothing wrong with other people. But what happens is when we expect too much of other people. We expect them to be a complete refuge for us, and they can't. So in terms of our categories for what we need for a refuge to be worthwhile, a refuge to be security for us, well, the first thing is that another person, they can't be a refuge to us because they're always changing, and not necessarily in a direction we want them to change either. So in terms of Buddhist terminology, until one has achieved irreversible insight, there's always a chance that you might fall back. There's always a chance that actually you might fall away from the spiritual life. So until you've achieved what's called stream entry or irreversible insight, you can always fall back. So other people, you don't know what they're going to do. And the more I've lived, the more I've realised that you just never, ever, ever know what people are going to do next. You don't know. And until stream entry, you can't know. They could be really, really gung-ho, ethical, Dharma warriors one minute and down the pub taking ease and going out clubbing the next. You really don't know what they're going to do until they've achieved irreversible insight. And the other thing is they might die, you know. We're not always going to be around forever. So they're not permanent. And in terms of breadth, we expect too much out of each individual person. So, and I've particularly noticed this with sexual partners. We expect them to be our lover, our mother, our father, our sister, our brother, our best friend, our counsellor, our home handy help. You know, our tutor, you know, we expect so much out of just one individual. And they can't satisfy every single need that we've got. They're not big enough. A human being just isn't big enough. And depth. There's this story about Samuel Johnson, who said that he always needed company because he was so afraid if he was on his own, this enormous melancholy would just take him over and he'd go mad. So he just spent all his time in company out of fear of madness. So it's a bit like what we do when we go for refuge and have unrealistic expectations on people is that we expect too much. We expect them to keep on giving. We expect them to take away our dukkha for us, to take away our sense of unsatisfactoriness. But we're not really seeing them for who they are. And we're not really seeing them that actually each human being has its limit. They can't take that existential dukkha away from us in particular, that kind of sense of loneliness. Only you can do that. Only you can do that by going beyond the distinction between self and other. So, so in a way, sexual relationships particularly, but also just going for refuge to people, they can't be a true refuge for us. Try as they might, they're not going to be able to be a true refuge for us. So the next thing is, we've got the queens, but then there's also the king and his army. So quite often what we do is we go for refuge, we make obeisance to status, power, and particularly, I think in our terms, since I don't think most of us are actually in the army, or kings, in fact, I think we try and get most of that in our career. Our career serves that purpose for us. So, let's apply our career to these criteria. Well, permanency. There's not such a thing as a job for life anymore, I'm afraid to say. Even if you get the best job in the world, then they'll do this thing called, they'll send around an email saying, would anyone like to take part in a voluntary redundancy scheme? And then you know what's going to come next. So a job can't be permanent. And at the very least, you're going to retire. You know, some people, when they retire, just have a complete nervous breakdown because they went for a few so strongly to their career and the career goes, what's left? So it's not permanent. And in terms of breadth, well, you know, our job can't encompass all of us. I think if you're very, very lucky if you can get a job that just engages you creatively at all, actually. And it's probably going to be a vocation for you, not not a job just for money. So, you know, even the work I do here, I love this place. It's the best job in the whole wide world, the whole wide universe. I've got the best job ever. But there are still times on a Wednesday evening when I've done the beginner's course for quite a number of years now, and you know, you get to that moment and you just think, I really wish I was in bed, you know, with a good book. And there's the 300 emails from people in West Africa trying to give us £1 million, and you just think, yeah, bed, good book, video with my mates in the park. So, you know, in a way, there's always going to be a bit of us that's left out of our job. It would be very, very rare to get a job that encompasses your whole being. And even if you get a really good job, well, you know, sometimes we go a bit flat. That's the way of things. Sometimes we get a bit bored in our jobs. So, depth as well. In a way, your job is limited. It can take you so far. You know, you can climb... the career ladder. But even altruistic jobs only go so far unless they deal with the spiritual development of the individual. It's not enough for us. We're lions in cages. And no matter how many kind of, I don't know what your jobs are, but you know, no matter how much you do, how much good work you do in your job, unless it deals with the absolute fulfillment of limited wisdom and limitless wisdom, limitless compassion in the individual, it's just a bit limited. It's just not enough for us. It's not enough for that lion in the cage. I haven't said anything about beautiful. Well, you know your job, you know whether it's beautiful or not, really. So the last thing is this show of wealth, the turquoises, the coral ornaments, the gold, the silken tents. That show of wealth, which in a way I think is a really key thing for us. We make obeisance to money we make obeisance to money because we think we can buy our way into security and we can buy our own happiness. So a lot of what we do in our life is motivated by how much money we can get out of it, how much money we can save by doing it. And in a way, again, there's nothing wrong with money in itself. Money in itself is neutral. But it's this constant pandering to the financial situation all the time, you know. Every choice that we make involves how much money it's going to cost. And it's a king. The money is a king to us. It rules us. It rules our everyday behaviour. And in a way, that's the way it's going to be because it's a capitalist economy. And in a capitalist economy, things are only worth doing if they're profitable. So we think that we can buy security. We can buy our way out of dukkha. We can buy our way out of dukkha with kind of big cars or bigger houses or bigger television sets, better mobile phones, smaller mobile phones with little cameras and whatever you have on your mobile phone. We can buy our way out of suffering with a holiday in the sun. But, you know, okay, well, let's go back and look at all this. You can't rely on possessions, you can't rely on money, because they're not permanent. You can think that you've amassed enough, but actually it can fall through your fingers. It can fall through your fingers through inflation, your house price can suddenly drop, your pension plan can just fall through, just like that. It doesn't take a lot, actually, for that money to disappear. You rely on possessions and they break. You get that beautiful big car, and it breaks down and costs you a lot of money to fix. You get that great house and you find out it's got rising damp, you know. So you can't rely on the permanency of material possessions and money, having money. But also, you know, it doesn't really do it for us, money. Because in a way, well, what is it? It's just a figure. It's just a number on your bank sheet. Or it's just a thing. And we tend to get very bored with things, actually. They do it for us for a while, but then, you know, what was really in fashion and really groovy to get the best mobile phone of one year is not the best mobile phone of the next year. So there's constantly a movement in technology, constantly a movement of thinking we could get better and better stuff, really. And actually what we find out is we need a lot less than we think we do. Actually, a lot of that stuff that we think is buying us out of dukkha isn't really, it's not really up to much. And actually we find our happiest moments have got nothing to do with money. And we don't need it all. We don't even need, you know, the TV and the video and the DVD player. You know, some people, myself included, my happiest times are on retreat. And there's no TV there. And I've got to wash all my clothes by hand. And a lot of the thing, you know, and I usually take a very small suitcase with only a few clothes. So actually, it's not, it doesn't really do it for us, money. And I was thinking about attractiveness. Okay, well, what are the archetypes of wealth and money? The archetype of going for refuge to money, I think, is Scrooge. So going for refuge to money is a bit like you're an old miser sitting there on Christmas Day counting your money. It's not particularly attractive. That's not particularly what I want to be when I grow up. What's the archetype of possessions and wealth? Well, Posh and Becks come to mind. Here they've got quite a lot of money, actually, and quite a big house and quite a lot of dresses, both Posh and Becks. Yeah, it's not going to do it for us. It's very, very limited. But as for a refuge, well, I know what Padmasambhava would have to say. I am Vajratara the beggar. Mine are the teachings of renunciation. I live hand to mouth. I am Vajratara the queen. Mine are the teachings of spiritual abundance. I live enriched with the Dharma. I am Vajratara the lover. Mine are the teachings of energy. I live enraptured, obsessed, intoxicated with the Dharma. I am Vajratara, the old hag. Mine are the teachings of contentment. I see beauty in friendship, not in clubs and short skirts. I am Vajratara, the old man. Mine are the teachings of simplicity. I don't hanker after an exciting life. I am Vajratara, the emperor. Mine are the teachings of Buddha pride. I hold the crown and scepter of the lineage of the Buddhas of all space and time. And you, king of money, king of pieces of low quality paper, anxiety and craving surround you. You rely on the greed of pandering fools. You stand haughty and high, thinking you are the ruler of all men and women, thinking that they would do anything you ask of them. But I, sire, will not bow down before you. And yet, in accordance with the rules of society, I have to earn and spend you. But I will only do that for the good of my true rulers, the three jewels. So, yes. So, okay, those are the false refuges, symbolized by the king and his entourage on one side of the river in Tibet. But can anyone guess what the true refuges might be? Should be fairly obvious by now. Yep, it's the three jewels. The Buddha, the ideal of enlightenment, our human potential. It's the Dharma, or the path and the teachings of Buddhism. And it's the Sangha. Now, the Sangha, in this particular sense, in terms of people who have achieved spiritual insight. So, in a way, I'm not going to, obviously we don't actually have time for me to go, I could do, it's a whole talk in itself about the true refuges and why the three jewels are true refuges. And I can't tell you about them in a way, because you've got to look for yourself. But what I can say is that, the spiritual life, which is the three jewels, they can't get taken away from you. They even last through death. You can even carry your momentum of your spiritual life through death. They're infinitely broad. They encompass all of you, the hermit and the bodhisattva, the spiritual hero and the spiritual renunciant. And okay, we've got all sorts of negative emotions, things we need to integrate. Well, they're just energy. They're just energy, and you bring them on the path to the Dharma. You can integrate that energy. So it's infinitely broad. It's infinitely deep. The spiritual life is infinitely deep. Even enlightenment doesn't take you to the end of the spiritual life. Even with enlightenment, there's further to go. And it's beautiful. There's something about the spiritual life which is beautiful. It's aesthetically pleasing. It's complete in itself. Although I do have to say, we do have to keep this going. And it is important, you know, spiritual life can feel sometimes a little dry. So it is important that you cultivate the aspects of the spiritual life that you enjoy. Puja, ritual, studying, whatever it is for you that you really enjoy, meditation. Then do, develop that and cultivate that. Because otherwise you won't go for refuge to the spiritual life, because it isn't interesting enough. So Padmasambhava is basically saying, he says, I won't look for security in all those false trappings. I won't look for security in your entourage. I won't bow down to those false refuges, because I have something so much greater. I have a refuge that really does it for me. I have something that is permanent, infinitely broad, infinitely deep, and infinitely beautiful. And you, king, and your entourage, sexual relationships, career, money, possessions, they're nothing. They're nothing compared to what I have, and I will not bow down to them. So it's quite something of Padmasambhava to say. He's saying there's only one master for Padmasambhava, and that's the spiritual life. No one else is going to be his master. No one else is going to take control of him. And I think it's quite sobering. We have to bring this to mind, because I think as Westerners, we have a tendency to think we can have it all. You know, I can have a really great career, really nice house, really nice car. I can have a really nice sexual partner and a really nice spiritual life. And I'll have it all set up for me just as the way I like it. Well, in some senses you can. in themselves, career, sexual partners, money and possessions, they're all okay. But actually, if you make gods out of those things, it's going to lead to a lot of suffering because they are not up to the job. So that's one thing. You'll end up being disappointed. And I've said this before, but I'll say it. When Sangharakshita came here from the opening, and he was asking me about why people didn't want to work in Buddhist businesses anymore. And I said, well, you know, people need more security. They want more security in their life than they feel that Buddhist businesses can offer them. And he said, ah, they want security, but they will never find it. And I was kind of a bit taken aback at that, and I thought, well, you know, I think I can buy myself security. But you see, what you don't realise is, well, for just on a certain level, we're living at a time that's been the most peaceful in the whole of human history. You don't realise this because of television, but actually there's less wars now than there ever has been. And we think that actually this is what it's going to be like forever. We think that terrorist bombings only happen in London, but they won't come up. Why would they come to Sheffield? Why would they come to Sheffield Buddhist Centre? But, you know, listen to history. There's been millions of people in history who thought exactly the same things as us. You know, what did the Jewish families in Germany think before the Second World War? You know, they had their jobs, they had their big houses. And they thought, well, that's it, you know, send my children to good school, send my children to university. And it went like that in an instant. Suddenly they were carted off to refugee camps. Suddenly they were carted off to be gassed in chambers. You know, people have been doing this for centuries. Palestinians, you know, university lecturers, family house that's been there for generations and generations. And then there's a war, and then they're suddenly a refugee in Jordan. You know, so I think you've got to be a bit more aware of history. You can't have it all. And you can't have it all staying the same for the rest of your life. People get ill, and they get ill quickly, and young people get ill. So in a way, in Buddhist terminology, we need to go forth from some of our false refuges. We can't see them as gods anymore. We can't let them rule us. We can't see them as kings, because they're not up to the job, those false refuges. But in terms of integration, which is what we're looking at as well, it takes a lot of energy to be enlightened. One of the key things is you need to develop a lot of energy. And often what happens with us is we waste it. We waste it on false refuges. It's almost like, I kind of have this vision of we've got too many kings that we're bowing and scraping to all the time. So if you've got too many kings you're kind of bowing and scraping to, you'll just spend your whole time kind of bowing and scraping and not really go very far with anything. It's like we're just too dissipated. We waste too much energy on areas and on things that just can't do it for us, that are just a bit limited. They're all right in themselves, but they're not really going to do it for us. And it's the same with time. If we spread ourselves too thin, you know, there simply isn't enough time to really, really, really develop, you know, your career, your culinary skills, your partner, your gardening, your dharma practice, blah 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 blah. You've got too many things that you're going for refuge to, too many things that you're that are the kings in your life. You just won't do anything any very well. So this is not about someone telling you off. Padmasambhava isn't telling you off. He's saying that going for refuge to false refuges leads to suffering, and he doesn't want you to suffer. And going for refuges to true refuges leads to satisfaction on a deeper level. It leads to satisfaction that you never dreamed was possible. It leads to that lion being let out of that cage. And in a way, that's what he's looking for. You're very, very precious and you're very valuable. And you have enormous potential. Each individual has enormous potential, and don't waste it. Don't waste it on things that just aren't good enough for you. Don't waste it on the wrong king. So I think I'll finish up there, but I'll just give one short reading just to make you feel a bit better. So, that all really. which is what Padmasambhava said to his disciple as he was leaving this, to the Copper Mountain. He said, "Padmasambhava's compassion does not rise and fall. In the light of my compassion will never cease to brighten Tibet. One need only ask, and Padmasambhava will appear before him. I am never far from those with faith, or even far from those without it, though they do not see me. My children will always be protected by my compassion."